As you can probably tell from the stories I've been telling, I've always been fascinated by lost worlds and ancient mysteries. When I was six or so, I couldn't get enough of Gene Autry and The Phantom Kingdom on afternoon TV. It just came out on DVD, and I'm going to buy it. It was about a 16-episode Saturday matinee serial combining singing cowboys, spaceships, and a lost civilization hidden under Gene Autry's ranch, led by a cruel but beautiful queen. When I was 10, I moved to a little city in Florida named Temple Terrace. It was laid out in 1924 as a grand Spanish colonial Moorish theme real estate development. And it went bust in 1926 with the whole Florida real estate market. I found a golf course shaded by live oaks and rutted asphalt streets winding through empty lots full of pine trees, dotted here and there with a few domed houses that had been built before the crash. They were really cool-looking houses. At the center of the whole village was a peeling, faded Spanish Morris casino and hotel. By the time we got there, the hotel was home to Florida Christian College, which was Billy Graham's alma mater. We swam in for a nickel in the hotel pool because it was now operated by the town. And the casino office had been repurposed for the town hall, and the old nightclub was our municipal auditorium, rented by our little Catholic parish for Sunday Mass and other small town events. In my imagination, the fading relics of this real estate bubble were the remnants of a grand civilization abandoned by the Spanish conquistadors. So my fascination with lost civilization, real or imagined, was the hook that got me reading the work of Jared Diamond, a professor of geography at UCLA who began his scientific career in physiology and expanded into evolutionary biology and biogeography, which meant he spent a lot of time off in places like Borneo, bird watching and studying the biology there. You may know his work from his earlier book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, which won the Pulitzer Prize, became a bestseller, and was the basis for a National Geographic documentary you might have caught on PBS. From this book, I learned that resources, geography, and disease have had a starring role in determining which societies were dominant at any one time. Not so much their innate intelligence or God's will, but who had the guns, germs, and steel. His next book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, inspired my fateful comment at Carol Topchick. So here I am. To start, I think it's a great read, at least if you are fascinated by science, geography, and anthropology as a grand adventure like I am. Collapse is sort of a detective story, firmly grounded in serious science. He talks about pollen and, you know, carbon dating and bones, about civilizations that face challenges to their survival and either changed and survived or continued on the same course and collapse. There's so much in there, I'm just giving you a little bit of a taste. And actually what I wanted to do was walk up here and just say, everybody read the book, and then I could go home. I wish this book had no entertainment beyond, had no importance beyond its entertainment value. I wish it didn't have important lessons for us today. But we are confronted every day with evidence that our nation and our world are facing human-caused changes to climate, overuse of resources, and the end of cheap fossil fuel. It may not be too melodramatic to say that if we don't respond to these challenges, we face the collapse of the world as we know it. If I were giving this sermon a year ago, I might have spent time trying to educate you and persuade you about the reality and magnitude of this change. But in the meantime, Al Gore's eloquent arguments and his forklift, the report from the UN Commission on Climate Change, and $3.79 a gallon gasoline have focused our attention. The topic of climate change has suddenly seized public consciousness. The Earth Day coverage this year has been amazing. Michael suggested I bring in the stack of publications that I've gotten about how to design green buildings and what we need to do to respond to Earth Day. I just couldn't schlep all that stuff with me. But I hope that you all caught the New York Times, Sunday Magazine last week, and an amazing graphic in the week, this week section showing what we could do by four simple steps to reduce carbon and use of fossil fuels. But anyway, even at work, I'm getting stacks and stacks of trade publications on the subject of sustainable design, ways to reduce energy usage, information about products grown or manufactured in sustainable ways, and guidance in making tough decisions. The company I work for as an architect has asked all of its 700 or so employees to attend bi-weekly lunchtime webcasts to learn how to design sustainable buildings. And I swear, at the first one, first PowerPoint, or maybe like the third slide, I nearly dropped my pizza when I heard, "We are all part of the interdependent web of life." And I wondered, is there a Unitarian lurking up there? We may be coming to our senses, but will this just be a fad? When Clorox markets green cleaning products, and it is, and they're endorsed by the Sierra Club, is it just greenwashing, or have we started moving change into the mainstream? Will we be able to bring about meaningful change? Will it be done before the climate of the Earth is irrevocably altered in ways that will bring about unimaginable suffering? I don't mean to be a downer, but suffering that will probably affect the poor and powerless first, as in Bangladesh, Haiti, Darfur, Rwanda, and New Orleans, but will affect all of us who live here on our blue boat home. Why look at ancient societies to figure out what's happening today? Diamond begins his book with descriptions of two dairy farms, both facing similar challenges of climates that don't favor dairy farming, rising costs for energy and transportation, and economies that are hostage to forces beyond their control. One, Hull's Farm, is a high-tech operation located in the Bitterroot Valley of Montana. The other, Gardar Farm, the former manor farm of the Norse Bishop of southwestern Greenland, was abandoned over 500 years ago. In Diamond's words, quote, "My trips to Hull's and Gardar Farms, thousands of miles apart, but visited during the same summer, vividly brought home to me the conclusions that even the richest, technologically most advanced societies today face growing environmental and economic problems that should not be underestimated. Many of our problems are broadly similar to those that undermine Gardar Farm and Norse Greenland, and that many past societies also struggled to solve. Some of those past societies failed, like the Greenland Norse, and others succeeded, like the Japanese and Tikopians. The Japanese instituted strong laws against cutting trees and instituted reforestation. The Tikopians were a small island, small island in Polynesia that decided, even though pigs were their most favored form of food, they were destroying the environment, so they banned them, and they lived this way for 1,000 years. The past offers a rich database from which we can learn in order that we may keep succeeding. Diamond explains, by collapse, I mean a drastic decrease in human population size and or political, economic, social complexity over a considerable area for an extended period of time. The processes through which past societies have undermined themselves by damaging their environments fall into 8 categories: deforestation and habitat destruction, soil problems, water management problems, overhunting, overfishing, effects of introduced species on native species, human population growth, and increased per capita impact of people. The environmental problems facing us today, and I'm still quoting from Diamond, include the same 8 that undermine past societies, plus 4 new ones. Human-caused climate change, buildup of toxic chemicals in the environment, energy shortages, and full human utilization of the Earth's photosynthetic capacity. Most of these 12 threats, it is claimed, will become globally critical within the next few decades. Either we solve the problems by then, or the problems will undermine not just Somalia, but also first world societies. Much more likely than a doomsday scenario involving human extinction or an apocalyptic collapse of industrial civilization would be just a future of significantly lower living standards, chronically higher risks, in the undermining of what we now consider some of our key values. If this reasoning is correct, then our efforts today will determine the state of the world in which the current generation of children and young adults lives out their middle and late years. And I just turned 60 today, and with luck, I'll see the next act of this drama. One of the most puzzling questions is why the doomed societies continue to march towards destruction. Or as one of Diamond's UCLA grad students asked, what went through the mind of the person who cut down the last tree on Easter Island? There were many reasons society continues on a course of destruction. They may not understand the consequences of their action in time to change course. They may not know how to change course. The interests of the powerful may clash with the broader needs of society, or the society may lack leadership to change. But one of the contributory factors Diamond talked about that really caught my attention was that a society may know it's in trouble, but be so tied to its values and self-image that it's not able to save itself. Easter Island is one of the most remote places in the world. It was settled by Polynesians exploring the Pacific who found a lush island of trees that provided shade, food, logs for canoes, fiber for ropes, and organic materials to renew the thin, relatively infertile soils. The settlers could rely on food for food on flocks of seabirds that made their homes on Easter Island. Because of its geography, there were few fishes close to shore. The islanders took their big canoes out into the ocean to catch the abundant dolphin. Ultimately, spurred on by the priestly ruling class to compete in building bigger monuments, the Easter Islanders cut down the trees faster than the new trees could regenerate in thin soil. The islanders could no longer go to sea to catch dolphin, eliminating an important source of food. The islanders assumed they could catch as many birds as they wanted, but when the Polynesians first settled the islands, they brought rats along with them unintentionally, and the rats ate the birds' eggs, and soon all the seabirds on the island disappeared. Easter Islanders were unable to let go of the religious structures and clan rivalries that motivated them to denude their island of trees in a headlong rush to build bigger and bigger monuments. Diamond devotes a large portion of Collapse to telling the story of the colonies founded by the Norse, starting about 800 AD during their thrilling explorations of the North Atlantic. He also tells how he watched Kirk Douglas in the movie about the Norse and how exciting that was. But the real Norsemen, they ranged from the Orkney Islands, 11 miles off of Scotland, to Iceland, then Greenland, and finally, in 1000 AD, they founded a very short-lived colony in far-off Vineland. For a long time, it was thought that the whole concept of the Norse exploring North America was just a fable. And recently, archaeology has shown that they actually had a colony in Newfoundland for about 10 years, but it was abandoned after 10 years because of the difficulty of restocking it. Each of these colonies had a different history. Vineland, as I said, was abandoned after 10 years. Iceland faced and overcame terrible environmental problems. It survives today, become one of the most prosperous countries in the world, and you can go there and listen to music, sitting in a hot tub, drinking a martini. Now, and the hot tub is thermally heated from the volcanoes. The Norse settlement of Greenland lasted just short of 500 years. The Norse settlers to Greenland found green fields and forest that promised the same bountiful wheat crops, dairy farms, and pork as they had enjoyed in Norway. They didn't realize that the thin volcanic soil in the far north latitude meant that the promising harvests of the early years could not be sustained. Using the same methods of working the land that worked in Norway. This wasn't Norway, but it looked like it. Their economy and way of life depended on trading ivory and furs to Europe for necessities, such as iron and timber, as well as luxuries like church bells, stained glass windows, and silk vestments. These crossed the vast North Atlantic distances to Norway. But in time, because of changing fashion and new trade routes to the east, through what is right now Russia, Norway lost interest in bringing back ivory and furs from this little outpost. Just as the climate began to change and crossings of North Atlantic became more treacherous and infrequent. As the colony faced declining yields to their harvests and waning trade, the Greenlanders clung to their Norwegian traditions and were not interested in adapting their ways to the realities they faced. One poignant example is that they expended precious resources to build elaborate churches and tithe to support the Catholic Church. They never changed their image of themselves as European Christian farmers and never adopted the Inuit Eskimo strategies for survival, such as fishing and whaling. And there's a very poignant line in the book. Diamond researched a lot of the Norwegian records. And there was a record in a book somewhere that they hadn't heard from the people in Greenland for 80 years, and maybe they should send out a boat and see how they're doing. They did, and there was no one left. Closer to home, we can see countries today that have taken divergent paths. A striking example in collapse is the island of Hispaniola, one island with two countries divided by race, history, and environment. Haiti, which occupies the western half of the island, is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere and one of the poorest in the world. It is almost completely deforested, and as a result, it suffers some loss of soil, landslides, and these are a major factor in the chronic hunger faced by Haitians. The other side of the island is occupied by the Dominican Republic, a country with its own history of poverty and political corruption and repression, but a land of lush tropical forests that can feed its people and can attract tourists, thanks to some good decisions by some of the DR's less than democratic leaders, who created national parks and backed them up and insisted that the forests be kept. The stories of collapsed societies made me want to slap my forehead and say, what were they thinking? In defense of these past societies, we have the advantage of hindsight. The leaders of Greenland, Easter Island, and the other case studies in the book lacked computer models, satellite photographs, the detailed historic records we have as tools to look at our situation. Those wonderful scientific tools, the best that any civilization has ever had to help us see the troubles up ahead, won't help us unless we are ready to confront the outmoded values that are leading us into trouble. You can probably think of these outmoded values, but let me suggest some. There is no crisis, it's all a myth. If it isn't a myth, there's a technological fix that will help us get out of this with no change to our lifestyle. I have to confess, today, for the first time in about 5 years, John and I actually took one car to the fellowship, because normally I get here first, he wants to come 20 minutes later, so we have two cars. And I said, I can't get up here and say this if we have two cars. All right, more of these values. Winning is everything, and the winner has the biggest house, the biggest car, and the biggest SUV. Faster is better, even if it takes more gas to run your car fast. Public transportation is for losers. Meat is the food of advanced westernized societies, and vegetarian diets are for the poor. The rest of the world, by the way, is adopting this idea. The only acceptable solution for controlling carbon emissions is a free market solution. Raising taxes and imposing carbon caps will not work. The rest of the world will have to deal with this, but not the U.S. Another one. We can fix things by small changes, but no government action is needed. The other one, only government action is needed, and there's nothing we can do as individuals. Finally, I can find a nice gated community on high ground and avoid the problem. So this is really a downer. Why am I hopeful? Why does a book with the title Collapse ultimately end with a note of hope? We have advantages that the Easter Islanders, Mayans, and North never had. We can see that the change is taking place. We have the scientific process that gives us unparalleled insight into causes and solutions. We have technology. While it got us into this mess, maybe it can offer some alternatives. In my lifetime, our country has already tackled some serious environmental challenges and made significant progress when it had the political will. The Clean Air Act reduced smog, acid rain, and particulate pollution. The Clean Water Act led to cleaner drinking water in thousands of communities in the U.S. The Hudson River and New York Harbor used to be so full of chemicals and pollution, so full of the nasty chemicals that would kill anything, that it was known in wood preservation circles as a sterile environment. This meant that nobody had to worry about the piers in the harbor rotting because barnacles and shipworms couldn't eat them. They couldn't live in that water. Unfortunately, or fortunately, they've cleaned up the harbor and the river so much now that the pilings are rotting. The shipworms and the barnacles and the fish can start living there again. I wouldn't necessarily tell you to catch a fish in the harbor and eat it, but they're there. And when you look at the Hudson River, it's been cleaned up so much that there's a public swimming beach at Croton Point Park. Some of this was due to grassroots action by people such as the folk singer, activist, and Unitarian Pete Seeger to make people care about pollution that was destroying the beauty of the Hudson River. He had the crazy idea of having ordinary citizens work together to build a replica of an old Hudson River sloop so the children and grown-ups could get excited about spending time on the water and learn to care about the river that they were losing. The bottom-up pressure from Clearwater and groups like it was ultimately met by the will in Albany and Washington to do the right thing, and it wasn't easy. And the will isn't always there, but you got to keep pushing. I hate to remind you that the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act were signed into law by Richard Nixon. If I'm wrong, someone please correct me, but it was. So it's not a matter of which party, it's a matter of knowing the right thing to do. Our Unitarian Universalist values can lead us out of this fix if we really mean what we say in the fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. We will be open to questioning the beliefs that threaten our planet. If we really mean what we say in the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and in the sixth principle, the goal of the world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, we will recognize that we are all together here in the Blue Boat home and not be satisfied to let the poorest pay the price for climate change as they are now, or expect that the rising economies of the world will settle for less than the perks we have enjoyed up till now. I'm working with some young people from China who have better lifestyles than I do. And if we really mean what we say in the seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, we will be compelled to take action. Now,